everyone, Scott Bernstein here, and welcome to the Jambase Podcast. Jambase is proud to be the Osiris Podcast Network's media partner. This episode is sponsored by Nugsnet. Nugsnet is the live music app featuring over 15,000 shows from your favorite bands on demand and ad-free. You can listen to a show from last night or from 40 years ago. You can download music to listen offline and create playlists to share with your friends. While there's plenty of huge acts in the Nugsnet catalog, including Phish, Widespread Panic, and Dead & Company, there's also the chance to stream live shows from up-and-coming acts like Goose, Magic Beans, and Billy Strings. Plus, they keep on adding the Allman Brothers Band shows to the catalog, which I'm personally really excited to see. As live music fanatics like us, the folks at Nugsnet are offering our listeners a free 30-day trial. Listen free for 30 days and cancel anytime. Visit nugs.net/jambasepodcast to get started. That's nugs.net/jambasepodcast. All right, let's get on with the show. Co-hosting this episode with me is Andy Kahn. AK, what do we have in store for this episode?
Hey, Scotty B. Well, soon we'll get started with the rundown, where we'll cover recent events in the world of music. Plus, Scotty and I will discuss some recent shows we saw on our trip to California. Following the rundown is Scotty's Musical Mentors interview with keyboardist Marco Benevento. We'll get to Scotty and Marco's chat in just a minute, but now let's get to the rundown. We begin with the sad news of the death of Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter, who passed away this week at the age of 78. Hunter and his longtime writing partner Jerry Garcia co-wrote many of the Grateful Dead's beloved songs. Hunter met Jerry Garcia when they were both teenagers, and the pair performed together as a duo as well as in bluegrass groups. Garcia went on to form the Warlocks, who in 1965 changed their name to the Grateful Dead. Robert witnessed the Dead's first concert and forged a songwriting relationship with Garcia that would last until Jerry's death in 1995. Hunter's earliest contributions to the Dead were the lyrics to St. Stephen, China Cat Sunflower, and Alligator. Robert sent the lyrics to Jerry, who replied to Hunter asking him to become the band's lyricist. Hunter was responsible for the words to many of the band's most well-known songs, including Uncle John's Band, Ripple, Truckin', Friend of the Devil, Black Muddy River, Eyes of the World, Touch of Grey, Scarlet Begonias, and Franklin's Tower. Robert was also a performer and embarked on a few tours as a solo artist, including one in 2014. Following Jerry's death, Hunter continued to write and contribute lyrics to such artists as Bob Dylan, Seven Walkers, Mickey Hart, Steve Kimmock, and the String Cheese Incident. In 2013, Robert received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Americana Music Association, and the next year, he and Garcia were inducted in the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Grateful Dead members Phil Lesh, Mickey Hart, Bill Kreutzmann, and Phil Lesh all expressed condolences and shared heartfelt remembrances of Hunter. Trey Anastasio, John Mayer, Warren Haynes, Steve Kimmock, Jim Lauderdale, and many others also posted messages expressing the importance of Hunter's lyrics. All of us at Jambase share our condolences with Robert's friends and family. Fare you well, Robert.
Fare you well. Fare you well, I love you more than words can tell. Listen to the river sing sweet songs to rock my soul. Do-do-do.
Rolling on with the rundown, Andy and I recently went west to California, where we joined many of the members of Team Jambase in Big Sur for Yola Tango's camping weekend at the Fernwood Resort. The two-day event featured several other acts besides Yola. Andy, who did we see that weekend?
Well, on Friday, we saw Kevin Morby headline with an outstanding solo set. Morby was added to the lineup in place of Purple Mountains, whose frontman David Berman tragically died in August. Berman's spirit loomed over the event all weekend, as many of the artists addressed his loss from the stage. Morby ended his set by covering several of Berman's songs, including The Silver Jews, and he did so with the help of Katie Crutchfield. Katie also played a set as she does as Waxahachie. It was perfectly matched with the setting sun and the majestic surrounding landscape. Friday, we also got to see a performance by the legendary Japanese folk artist Sachiko Kanobu, and an opening set by Leah Isis. Saturday's lineup was friend of the Jambase podcast, guitarist William Tyler, and he played a captivating opening set right ahead of Yola Tango. William mentioned he had driven for several days just to play the opening set for Yola. Some of my highlights from the Yola Tango's headlining set were the always fun to see Mr. Tough, along with Stockholm Syndrome, The Point of It, and several of the new tunes from their excellent new album, There's a Riot Going On. I loved getting to see the story of Yola Tango, which they really stretched out and jammed on. It was awesome. I love seeing that song in person. And Yola Tango is always good for some solid covers, which they delivered in the form of the Beach Boys' Sloop John B and Big Star's Take Care, which closed the set. I can't say enough about the Fernwood Resort and the promoters Folk Yeah Presents. They really have a special thing going on out there, and I just can't wait to get back to see more live music in that incredibly unique environment.
Man, Andy really said it. There's just no other venue like Fernwood, and I was blown away by the beauty of the spot. I was also extremely impressed by the audience. You can hear a pin drop during most of the performances, and I think the musicians really appreciated how attentive the crowd was. For me, this was my second time seeing William Tyler live, and I continue to be extremely impressed not only with his music, but by his stage presence. It was clear William was excited not only to be performing in Big Sur, but to be opening for Yola Tango. Sadly for us, Tyler didn't collaborate with Yola, but they did get together a few nights later for a set in San Francisco. I was also taken aback by Yola Tango's ability to go from 0 to 60 at a moment's notice. The change of dynamics from one minute to the next was incredible. When we left Big Sur to head back to the Bay Area, we stopped in Santa Cruz to catch Sunday's action at Santa Cruz Mountain Soul. The Golden Gate Wingmen were playing as we entered the festival site. The band is made up of John Kadlicek on guitar, Jeff Cometti on keyboards, Jay Lane on drums, and Reed Mathis on bass. Their Mountain Soul set featured a mix of Grateful Dead tunes like Lazy River Road and Help on the Way, with covers of Bob Dylan's Just Like a Woman and John Lennon's Nobody Told Me, with some John Kay and Reed Mathis originals. Bob Weir came out at the end of the Golden Gate Wingmen set for a performance of the Grateful Dead's Terrapin Station. After the Wingmen, we caught Billy String's set. The talented guitarist performed with his typical bandmates, banjo player Billy Falling, bassist Royal Massat, and mandolin player Jared Walker. Billy just released a new album entitled Home, and I really enjoyed the live version of Taking Water from the LP that Strings and his band played. The songs from the album seem that they're going to be fitting in nicely in Billy's repertoire. In a shocker to jam fans, I'm sure, I thought the quartet were at their best when they were jamming, and the Turmoil and Tinfoil jam in particular was sweet. Billy had his hair tied back for the entire set, but he really let it fly during the Turmoil and Tinfoil finale, which made for quite the visual. Finally, we saw Bob Weir and Wolf Brothers close out the day of performances. Playing a second set of the day, Jay Lane backed Bobby on drums alongside Don Was on upright bass. The trio bookended their single set with Not Fade Away, filling in with staples from Bobby's repertoire in between. The Wolf Brothers' Sunday evening appearance, of course, included the Sunday Sermon, Samson and Delilah, which was played alongside Hunter Garcia classics, Bertha, Althea, Eyes of the World, Shakedown Street, Standing on the Moon, and China Cat, which segued into I Know Your Rider to end the set. Bobby and his brothers began the encore with Hunter's Broke Down Palace before closing with the aforementioned Return to Not Fade Away. There was another special show you caught in San Francisco last week, Andy. Who'd you get to see at the Great American Music Hall?
Well, I was lucky enough to get to see Brandi Carlile open for Courtney Marie Andrews. That's right. Brandi was the opener that night at the intimate Great American Music Hall, despite her having recently sold out Madison Square Garden as a headliner. Carlile said she wanted to walk the walk and support other women musicians, which she did literally for Courtney Marie Andrews at Great American. Brandi performed solo and dug deep into her songbook for several rarities. She also debuted Heroes and Songs and was joined by an impressive 15-year-old singer, Willa Amai, on Every Time I Hear That Song. Brandi also covered Joni Mitchell's River with Courtney Marie Andrews, and Carlile asked the audience not to record before she played an emotional cover of Mitchell's Little Green. Carlile also joined Andrews during her set, sitting in on May Your Kindness Remain. The entire evening was really special, and I give Brandi all the credit in the world for supporting her fellow musicians, which she also did later in the week by opening for Lucy Silvas at the Boulder Theater in Colorado. Hey, if you're listening, Brandi, the Twin Cities could be a great spot to open for someone next. I'm just saying. So that's it for the rundown. Next up is Scotty's Musical Mentors interview with Marco Benevento. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by Nugs.net. Thank you. NugsNet is the live music app featuring 15,000 shows from your favorite band, on demand and ad-free. You can listen to a show from last night or from 40 years ago. You can download music to listen offline and create playlists to share with your friends. I love to be able to listen to live recordings on NugsNet right after reading on Jambase about shows played by the likes of Umphrey's McGee, Government Mule, Green Sky Bluegrass, Pigeons Playing Ping Pong, and many, many others. All of the sit-ins, bust-outs, new covers, massive jams, and other cool parts of shows are right there to stream. As live music fanatics like us, the folks at NugsNet are offering our listeners a free 30-day trial. Listen free for 30 days and cancel anytime. Visit nugs.net/jambasepodcast to get started.
Let it slide, just let it slide.
Welcome back to the Jambase Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein, and joining me today at Jambase's New York City headquarters is Marco Benevento. How's it going, Marco?
It's going great. Thanks for having me.
Marco recently released his latest studio album, Let It Slide, via his own Royal Potato Family label. And we're going to talk musical mentors, and let's start with the new album. Marco, for this release, you worked with an outside producer, Leon Michaels. Can you talk a little bit about how you met him?
Sure, yeah. Speaking of mentors, he's become my new mentor.
Perfect.
I met him through Richard Swift, who we made a record with back in 2014. And
who sadly has passed away.
And Richard connected us because he asked if I could sub for Leon in The Arcs, which was Dan Arbeck's project a few years back. And it was just for like the last week of a tour.
Right.
So I went on the road with them and met them. You know, I hung out with Leon at a show, and he showed me the way around the rig and blah blah blah. And then he left and missed the rest of the tour. But I remember meeting him and like just kind of being like, whoa, like I didn't know anything about him.
Okay.
And I remember being like, I gotta check out this dude's stuff. Like everybody seemed to almost look up to him, like. The way like Dan was like looking up, I don't know, you could see that like Leon was like, he's like the guy.
Right.
You know, and I was like, I don't know much about him. So I just, you know, listened to a bunch of his music, bought a bunch of his records and was like, oh man, this is sounds so good. All of his stuff sounds so good. And we, I mentioned to Richard that I was working on a new record and he was like, oh yeah, you should hit up Leon. You should make a record with Leon. So I hit him up, and that's how we got connected. And I've learned so much working with him, and he's now like a super close friend that we hang out and like play tennis all the time and work on music, and our kids are the same age.
And I read that because of that, you pretty much had your hours in between the kids' days.
Yeah.
So you got stuff done between, say, like 10 and 3.
Exactly, yeah. It was like we'd get up and play tennis and you know, hang out. And we were, like, at the same level. Like, we would really, you know, play pretty hard together and, like, have a really good time and, like, really get competitive and then, like, drop it all and just go, like, work on tunes for, like, 3 hours. And then the kids would come back and we'd be like, all right, see you later. But, yeah, Leon was great to work with. I'd never worked with a producer before, so it was cool to have someone else's, you know, ears on all my stuff and hands on all the tracks and stuff.
Was it hard to give up the control that comes with working with an outside producer?
It wasn't actually. This was the one record where, yeah, I know what you're saying. Like you could picture like a musician and a producer in a room and like a producer being like, I don't know, we should add, you know, this and that. And the artist being like, no, it's supposed to go like this. And then, no, there was zero of that. It was full on like anything Leon suggested. I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Let's do it. You know, I had my hands up. I just was kind of done with the demos that we had. And we had played some of the songs live and I didn't know how or what the songs needed. And I really kind of wanted somebody to be like, oh, no, you should just do this. You should add this, do this. And Leon was totally that person who suggested a bunch of stuff. And I, you know, happily was like, yeah, this is a great idea. You know, he also gave me plenty of opportunity to chime in and do whatever I wanted to do. You know, like I would take the tracks back to my house and overdub a bunch of my own synths and do my own thing on it and bring it back to him and be like, I don't know, what do you think? I did this at my house last night. He's like, oh, cool. It sounds great. You know,
so it was a full-on collaboration.
Yeah, it was a full-on collaboration. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you've been providing your own vocals for the last few records after having Kalmia from Rubble Bucket do it a bunch of albums back. Can you tell us a little bit about the lessons that you took from working with Wyndham Boylan Garnett and the lessons that the voice lessons that...
Yeah, totally. Do you know Wyndham?
I mean, I'm familiar with the fact that once you decided to start singing, reached out, and that's
I did, yeah,
your formal training.
Yeah, him and Lola came on the road with us, and they would always do vocal exercises before their shows. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I've never done this before, you know. I'm like, oh, you should do it. So I would do stuff with them before shows, and it was very helpful. I also took some vocal lessons in Woodstock with like the local like lady who taught my kids piano lessons, and she was like, "Oh, you should do a vocal lesson." And I've done a couple with her just on like breathing and exercises and things like that to do. And it's definitely helped me. I'm still trying to figure that out. I could use all sorts of coaching and exercises and advice from professional singers and people who are maintaining their voices on the road. But I have kind of figured it out myself in a way, like where I feel like I know what's right and I know what's comfortable. I've learned that sometimes if I sing too much before the gig, it actually messes me up.
Okay.
It's kind of weird. I get like kind of tired, vocally tired, and wind up blowing my voice, and like I just did. But I remember one time we were touring in Colorado, and I completely lost my voice. Like I couldn't even talk, and it was either the dry air, the altitude, or I was pushing my vocal thing, or I don't know what. And I couldn't sing, and it was like this sort of like rude awakening of like, oh yeah, so now if you're gonna call yourself a singer now, you need to learn how to maintain your thing. And I kind of have learned to not overdo it beforehand, and also to not talk to too many people afterwards,
right?
Because I'll start getting, it's really the talking and being social after the gigs that really I feel like blows my voice out. But
especially on a 10-day run,
yeah,
where
yeah,
got
exactly,
eight or nine shows,
yeah, yeah. But I'm still learning how to become a singer, even though I you know, I did a lot of singing when I was a kid, but you know, had a long period of time where I didn't do any singing, did a lot of improvisation and a lot of jazz and experimental music, and then over the last sort of 3 years I've figured out how to do it a little better and maintain it. But yeah, I could definitely still use some advice, or you know, maybe there's something out there somebody can share with me. But
well, folks, I'm sure you know how to get in touch with Marco, so if there's anyone out there. But let's go back to the beginning. Can you tell us about the first instrument that you ever played?
Yeah, I mean, the piano has always been my instrument.
Did you have a piano at home growing up?
Yeah, I did. Which is kind of weird because my parents don't play piano at all, but I feel like in Jersey around the, you know, mid 80s, I feel like a lot of people had pianos in their house, like in the suburbs. I don't know. A lot of
maybe it's interior decorators.
Yeah, exactly. Pianos. There was always a piano like at my cousin's house or my friend's house. Someone there was, you know, was always there, and you took like lessons from a boring piano teacher that you didn't like, and then they eventually quit. But I got into it. What really got me into it, though, was putting headphones on, like, and playing a synthesizer. Like that really turned me on to like sounds. Like the piano almost got boring for me at some point. I was like, it's just too whatever. You can't change sounds, and I liked like sort of huddling up in my room and recording on the synthesizer onto a four track with like a drum machine and another synthesizer and like a sound effects. I like making like weird stuff, weird, almost soundtracky sort of stuff.
And it's always been that way?
It's always been that way. it's definitely always been that way. It still is that way. I played bass for a little bit of time. I liked playing bass. I like playing drums too. I took a bunch of like hand drum lessons. I like learning about Afro-Cuban rhythms and stuff on the drums, on the congas.
But and I'm sure that adapts to piano playing.
Oh, absolutely, playing as well. You know, it's a percussive instrument, so it's a rhythmic instrument with notes. So yeah, I'm very much a rhythm player and get around the piano, you know, like that frequently, you know, like do a lot of rhythmic sort of jamming with Karina and DB.
Sure.
Yeah.
And your first synth was do you remember what it was?
Yes, I do, and I still have it.
Oh, that's great.
And it's a Casio, it was a Casio 8000, I think it was, which is pretty rare. And I just got the drum machine that you can attach to it, which is kind of crazy. I had this old synthesizer. It's like more of just a keyboard that I had forever. It was kind of boring. But then my buddy, like just like a few years back, he was like, I think this is the drum machine that attaches to this keyboard. I'm like, whoa, no way. I didn't even know it. But anyway, so this Casio Tone and this drum machine that comes with it have been like, that's a lot of the sounds that are on the record Swift that we made is like a lot of that Casio Tone. There was also a Kawaii keyboard, a Kawaii K1. I remember like getting into that and figuring out how to make sounds. Super cheesy sort of stuff, but like I loved it. And then Korg Poly 6 was a big one.
That was
a big one for me because it was analog, you know, you can only play six notes at a time, and there were all these knobs on it with, you know, analog switches and stuff, arpeggiator on it. And Poly 6 was a big one. I still have the Poly 6 too.
That's great. Yeah. I'm sure the girls will start using those.
Totally.
So when you were in high school and high school bands, were there any mentors that I know you did a lot of playing and experimenting at home, but was there anyone that sticks out as a mentor in terms
of? Yeah, absolutely. Joe Russo and I went to the same middle school, 7th and 8th grade. We went to Franklin Ave Middle School, FAMS.
That's
This one teacher, man, he's the best, and he's still there. I think he's moved up to a guidance counselor, but he was the music teacher. His name is Bill Gorton.
Okay.
And he basically taught Joe and I like words like, no, man, you just vamp. And you're like, what does vamp mean? He's like, you just play on, just vamp. Just stay in that one chord for a while and vamp. I'm like, okay, vamp. Like, I'm like... But he was like a drummer that played gigs, played, you know, was out there playing dances and all sorts of stuff. He was just a musician that worked and did all sorts of gigs. And, you know, he was a professional musician that also taught at the middle school. And he was a cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he sort of taught us how to just like, I don't know, this is like in 7th and 8th grade when you're maybe starting to feel a little bit more comfortable on your instrument, if you've learned a little, you know, when you were at a young age. But, you know, and he would just sort of be like, yeah, no, it just goes like this. Just play C7, add this note, you know, C, you know, and you're like, oh, wow. You know, he kind of made me aware of like the practicality of music and how you're supposed to know what to do. And then you vamp and then you comp, you know, and I'm like, what does comp mean? He's like, just accompany me, like, you know. Play some chords here and there. That was like one of my earliest memories of a mentor, I would say. I mean, besides like my dad, who loved to sing and loved Italian traditional Neapolitan songs, and he would sort of turn me on to these like, you know, operatic Italian, catchy sort of Italian tunes. But he, you know, he's not a musician. He's
A fan.
Yeah, exactly. He's a fan. He liked jazz. He turned me on to jazz and stuff growing up. But then, yeah, later in life, I went to college. I was just trying to think of if there was someone in high school that was a mentor, you know, but I don't think there was. In college, I had a bunch of great teachers, and I was way into jazz and studied with Joanne Brachin, and she lives here in Manhattan. She really kicked my ass and took me to this next level of jazz improvisation and just as a musician, you know, in that whole scene.
Yeah, it's interesting. You go to school, you go to a place like Berkeley, and you pay money to get your ass kicked.
Yeah. You're right. You pay a lot of money for teachers to say you're doing it all wrong and you need to practice, which is great. You know, I mean, I needed that kick in the butt, and I needed to you know, call myself a musician and, you know, had to figure out what that meant. And that meant, like, putting in your hours of practicing and knowing what stuff, knowing how to do it. I mean, I'm still learning all the time, but, you know, as far as, you know, jazz and like virtuosic stuff goes, like she really got me into sort of a whole nother level, you know, of chops or whatever.
And when you graduated from Berkeley and you moved to Brooklyn, you still took lessons.
I did, actually. Yeah. And I studied with Brad Meldow. Brad Meldow was a, that was just one lesson. That was like a gift from my girlfriend at the time. I'd been seeing him for a while, and she like got his number and she like got me a whole day lesson with him, and that was really inspiring. It was 2002. Okay. So I was
right after college.
Yeah, right after college. I was like 24.
Right. And those were the days of gigging with Joe.
Those were the days of gigging with Joe.
Doing residencies.
Yeah. God, I'm just like going down memory lane. Yeah, that's true. And then at some point, I just was like, look, I need to stop. Taking lessons with someone, and I need to just learn how to just be my own musician and like say yes to tours and just go and write music and make records and try to figure that whole thing out. Cause I was I was lucky enough to go to music college and learn that. And then after college, I still studied with Joanne and with various other people. But at some point I was like, man, I gotta just make my own art.
Yeah.
Like figure it out. Like, cause I'm like 25 or 26, and I it's okay, I'm good. Like, I put in a lot of hours, and let's go figure out how to make art.
So. And unfortunately, what comes with art sometimes is the business. Is there someone that's been a mentor on the industry side of things?
Well, my manager, Kevin, who's sitting right behind me, we started this whole record label together, the Royal Potato Family, like 10 years ago. 12 years ago.
That's Kevin Calabro.
I met him when he was working with Hyena. It was a record label that put out my first record, Invisible Baby. They were the ones that first put it out. Now we've reissued it under our own label. But yeah, working with Kevin has been awesome. I mean, it's like super roots, you know, DIY, like from like, my wife helping us to make the artwork for the records, or a friend's painting for the artwork, to like using, you know, a studio that we know through a friend, or I don't know. It's just, and then, you know, putting on our own records. I mean, it's been like a really great process, and seeing Kevin grow and like the publicity and the way everything's just been growing like constantly over the last 10 years. It's been cool been really cool to see that.
As a music fan, I appreciate having the avenue of Royal Potato Family to share the music by folks that might not get out there or out there as much otherwise.
Yeah. And, you know, Joe Russo even, too, you know, he's a good businessman. You know, he really sort of helped me just see things, like see what's going on. Like I didn't really know much. Joe did a bunch of touring way before I did with Fat Mama, and saw a bit of the business side of things, from Pete Shapiro and the Wetlands to, you know, the whole scene in Boulder, Colorado, you know, to, I don't know, all touring and all sorts of stuff, to the beginnings of Jam Bass all this stuff, you know.
Yeah,
it's just kind of made me aware of certain things that, you know, you should or shouldn't do. Getting advice from someone your same age is, who's seen a bit more than you, you're like, all right, okay, cool, good to know. I didn't know that you're not supposed to sign anything. Like, for a while, like managers come up to you, yeah, man, just sign this, we'll do a year. And I was like, Joe, we should just do this, right? We should sign this. And he's like, dude, I learned that you never sign anything.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, all right, good to know. Don't sign anything, you know. But, yeah. Yeah, a lot of it's from people that are around the same age as me.
Sure.
As far as the business goes.
And it must have been an interesting experience in 2006, playing huge sheds with Trey and Mike.
Right. Yeah, that was a great experience. I was basically completely out of the business and was just on a tour bus with Joe and Mike and Trey and their tour manager and just living it up.
Right.
Know, it was amazing. That was a fun summer.
To some of those venues with Joe Russo's Almost Dead.
And,
you know, I know you've talked about you listening to Rocket for the first time by Herbie Hancock, and that In Memory of Elizabeth Reed was an early influence, and the Meters.
Yeah.
But did you listen to the Dead at all growing up?
Absolutely, I did. I liked the Dead. I saw the Dead twice, 95 and 96. And it was a giant stadium. Steve Miller Band opened up.
Okay, so it must have been 94, 95.
Yeah. Steve Miller Band opened up, and then Sting opened up one year.
Oh, very cool.
I liked them. I mean, if I wore Tevas and tie-dyes, like, and I didn't know who the Dead was, you know, people would be like, dude, what's wrong with you? Like, if you're a hippie, you're supposed to listen to the Grateful Dead. And I liked the Dead, and I did listen to them. I liked other stuff more.
Sure.
There's something about the Dead during my, you know, teens, you know, that was a little too country for me. You know, I mean, I listen to the Dead a little bit more now,
right,
and have more Dead records now
than
I did. But I was more into like The Who and Cream and Led Zeppelin, and I liked the more hard hitting stuff. I liked the Meters. I liked the funk. But yeah, I appreciate and kind of am more into the Dead now. Same as like the band, you know.
Okay,
I wasn't really so much into the band. I didn't know all their tunes until now.
And in terms of the Dead, if you're gonna listen to one period or one of their keyboard players, is there one in particular that sticks out?
Yes. Definitely Pigpen. I mean, I love Pigpen.
Okay.
I love that early stuff. I love the way he sings. I love the crazy organ sounds he's got. I love the Dead's first record very, very much. You know, all that being said, though, I do like Wake of the Flood. I like that record a lot. Yeah, that's Keith. And American Beauty. I just got that on vinyl. Like, I don't know why it's taken me this long to get American Beauty on vinyl, but it's so good. And I just learned that the piano player was like, it was like some name I didn't even know.
Tom Constantine.
Oh, is that it? Yeah. It wasn't like a lot of the sort of typical names I've heard with keyboard players involved with the Dead. And then there's some amazing piano playing on that whole record.
And I think you'd really like that he was also a fan of toying with the piano.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
Palm muting strings and prepared piano.
I had no idea.
Yeah, he's an underrated figure in the Grateful Dead history.
Yeah. The piano playing on... Broke Down Palace?
Yeah.
Is that on? Is that, am I right?
Yeah, it's Working Man's. Working Man's at an American Beauty. I consider as one package.
Is Broke Down on American Beauty or is it?
I think it's on American Beauty. Oh, yeah. I'm not 100%.
The piano playing, I recently listened to that, like the album version. Yeah. I probably have heard it many times before, but just recently listened to it backstage at a J-Rad show because we were playing it that night. And I was like, man. Piano is really great on this track. It's awesome. Yeah. But anyway, Brent, Keith, Brent, but Pigpen, there's something like super visceral and dirty about Pigpen's thing that I just like freaking love. Like, absolutely love that style and sound.
Excellent. And finally, 2020 for you. It's going to be more of the same, touring with both bands.
Yeah. The rest of 2019, we have a bunch of shows with my band because the record's coming out this Friday.
It'll be out, I'm sure, by the time everyone hears this.
Okay, Let It Slide. Let It Slide is out. And we're doing a bunch of shows on the West Coast in December. We're doing a bunch of shows Midwest in November, and coming up in October, we're doing like New York and Boston and a lot of East Coast stuff, and then and we're also going to Japan.
Oh, wow! Yeah. Oh, awesome, Karina in Japan.
That's gonna be wild. I know. It's gonna be so much fun. Karina anywhere is wild and fun.
Sure,
but. And then, 2020, we'll be down south with my band, and we'll be in Texas, and then, juggling the schedule with both bands is basically what I'm doing. I think J-Rad's going to have a significant period of time where we're not doing any shows. I think like November, December, January. Well, I guess it's only 3 months.
Right.
We're just doing but 3 or 4 months.
But this year it's been every couple of weekends.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
3 months. Really,
I was just talking to Kevin about that. I was like, wow, we've been doing a lot of J-Rad shows the last month.
Yeah.
It's super fun. But yeah, it's been very busy. So I'm excited to hit the road and play all this new music for everybody, and to also see how all this new music fits into our set and everything like that. And of course, we have been incorporating those tunes into the set over the last, couple months. So we're already halfway there.
Terrific. Well, everyone be sure to track Marco on Jambase. You'll find all his tour dates from all his various projects, including his own band. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
All the thoughts you can't let go, let it slide.
That's it for this episode of the Jambase Podcast, which is one of the many podcasts in the Osiris Network. Visit Jambase to listen to all of the Osiris Network podcasts. This episode was brought to you by NugsNet. Get a free 30-day trial by visiting nugs.net/jambasepodcast to get started. As always, thanks to all of you out there for listening. And thanks also to Marco for chatting with us. Thanks to Telefunken for the microphones and to Jake Alexander for putting the episode together. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the Jambase Podcast. And if you like what you hear, give us 5 stars, leave a review, tell your friends. We'll be back soon. In the meantime, take care of each other and go see live music.